esteemed and lovely and talented Hub Arkish.
Hello.
Hub Arkish.
An experienced NFL reporter with decades of experience.
670 The Score's NFL insider.
Hub is excellent at his job and should be on TV somewhere because he doesn't have a face for radio, but that's for another time.
Shaw Media and Pro Football Weekly.
The other thing that is interesting is the way the ball is obviously jacked this year.
Uh-huh.
And to see these guys who are the main jackers.
Hub Arkish, that's getting better than this.
Hub Arkish with McNeil and Parkins on 670 The Score.
This hour on The Score brought to you by Team Hochberg. Visit their new website, 56david.com. That's 56david.com. We're going to talk to Hub at 4 o'clock on Tuesday. Tuesdays.
Yeah, it's Tuesday, Danny.
Yeah, it's all running together. It's just a weird week with the Bears playing last Thursday, but we love talking to Hub at this time because the All-22 film will normally be out by now. He'll have been able to review the Bears game from the previous Sunday, and he can tell us his big takeaways at this time. So Hub joins us on the Al Pamonte Ford Hotline. How you doing today, Hub?
I am good. How are you guys doing?
Outstanding. How perfect. Now that everybody's had a few extra days to get that taste out of their mouths, we can look at your film review and be reminded of how awful the offense was this past Thursday night.
You know, it was pretty bad. But the reality is, you didn't really need to see the tape to know. I mean, there was nothing that we missed Thursday night. The bottom line is that offensively, they didn't block the game particularly well. Mitch Trubisky did not read the game well, either in the passing or running games, and his receivers gave him no help whatsoever. The only group I'm not really going to fault is the running backs weren't awful. They made a little bit extra out of what was there. David Montgomery gave us just a couple flashes, and I actually asked Matt, it was the last question Friday of his post-game press conference, did Montgomery do enough to earn a few more touches? And if not, what's holding him back? And he didn't really answer the question. He talked more about the faith that they have in all three of their backs. But, you know, having not given a handoff to Tariq Cohen, obviously, you know, it got messy. And I think one of the things we're going to keep focusing on, and again, the tape is important, which guys played well. Not everybody was awful. Defensively, they were outstanding. But this team, to me, guys, just was not prepared. And I don't want to relive the debate about playing in the preseason or not playing in the preseason. But with Trubisky and where he's at in his development, to put him out there without trying to throw a single pass in 9 months at game speed, I just absolutely believe it's a big part of it. And I'm anxious to see what happens this Sunday. With everybody now with 60 minutes under their belt before I'm willing to panic about this offense.
What about Mitch was the most troubling to you specifically?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say he missed a lot of reads, but he certainly missed a few. It is certainly worth noting the Bears had 5 sacks, and every one of them were for significant losses for Aaron Rodgers. On the Packers sacks, on 4 of the 5, Trubisky was coming forward. And so that is a significant difference. That tells you that he helped out the pass rush. Now, whether he was forced to come forward, he came forward too soon, that's for, you know, Matt Nagy and Mark Helfrich and Dave Ragone to decide. But he just didn't at any point look comfortable in the pocket. And the one thing we know about Mitch from his first 26 starts, even 27, best pass he threw all night was on the roll right. He is better on the run throwing the football than he is in the pocket. And so I think they're going to be thinking about that a little bit. The other thing that was curious to me, there's a whole new line of thinking that has developed for me. And again, I got it from Nagy on Friday. Actually, I misspoke. I said the last thing was my question about Montgomery getting more touches. The last thing was him asking all of us to understand when we talk about the lack of the running game is that there were more runs called than we saw, that a good chunk of this running package is these RPOs, and that's in the hands of Mitch, whether he hands it off or throws it. And Trubisky himself acknowledged on that second, third, and one that was an RPO. He should have given the ball to the back. It probably would have been a first down. For whatever reason, he thought he saw something, he pulled it out. But it opens up a whole new conversation, is how much of the problems with the running game are, you know, Mitch not handing off the ball when he should.
Well, would you anticipate then more called runs because of that?
Mac, that would be the obvious answer to it, is you call more straight runs. Now, to do that, you've got to give up a part of your offense, but I think you always, when you have a performance like that, you dumb it down, you pull it back, you figure out what actually worked. And so I would think, game plan-wise, that's where I would start on Sunday, and we shall see. It's pretty easy to tell what's an RPO and what isn't, but it's not as easy to tell when they throw out of these RPOs, because that could be play action, that could be an RPO. Only the Bears, really know which. And I thought it was telling that Matt actually brought it up. I mean, he was asked a question, and he gave that as his answer. He did it without, he didn't throw anybody under the bus with it. But he's making the point that that's part of the development here. And so I do think it's probably one of the things we should watch most closely on Sunday.
Hub, I have an odd question for you. A couple of people on the text line are noticing it. By any chance, are you playing with a slinky?
Playing with a slinky?
I think it's the phone app is what it is. Okay. But it does, yes, it does. I'm trying to remember the jingle. A slinky. It's a fun and wonderful toy. It does sound slinky-ish, but it's just the app. It's clean. It's just slinky-ish.
Well, and I was so proud of myself because I finally went out last week after my Lucy Live failed on me again and went to the Apple Store and got the right connection for my headset. So I was hoping it was better. But
it's passable. Believe me, it's okay. Passable. It just sounds like you're playing with a slinky, which I think everyone kind of likes. I mean, I'm
like
more interested.
Hub with a slinky is good.
Yeah, silly putty maybe next Tuesday. Hub, you mentioned the blocking issues. And whether they're, last year we gave the offensive line pretty good credit for its, the way it protected Trubisky, but we still wondered, are they a man up and block people team? They've committed a lot of money to that group up front. Any reason to be concerned they're not as good as the Bears think they are?
I'm going to say not yet. Today is one of my favorite days. We only get this, I don't know if it's once a season, maybe a couple times a season, but we got a chance to visit at length with all of the position coaches. And I got to talk to Harry Hiestand at length. He was the first guy I visited with. And his explanation is we didn't have a good game. He said he didn't see anything that he is concerned about, ready to change. He didn't lose faith in anybody. It wasn't awful the whole game. But he said, in grading out the film and working with everybody now that we're back at practice, there was a lot that we need to clean up. And so I don't think there's anything to panic or worry about there yet. You guys know we've been talking about it for 2 years now. I've never been the world's biggest Charles Leno fan. One of the things you do notice when you go back and watch the All-22 is that he didn't have an awful game for 60 minutes. He just got those two incredibly bad penalties back-to-back. He did get beat on a couple speed rushes. That has always been a bit of an issue for him. But he wasn't awful. Kyle Long and James Daniels each had holding penalties. James Daniels got blown up on that one play by Kenny Clark. But none of them were bad for 60 minutes. And so, no, I don't think that you worry about that too much yet. I'll get back to the same thing. I asked Harry if there is any opportunity for these guys to, quote, block to the whistle in practice when they are not playing in any exhibition games. And he said, he adamantly answered the question, said, yes, it's different for the offensive and defensive line for everybody else. He said, we never do that in team, which is why the skill guys don't ever get that live game timing. He said, but when we do our position drills and we work with the defensive line, we do go all the way to the ground. So it's not as concerning the lack of game time prior to the opener than it is with the other positions. And that's why, again, I accept that when a coach looks you in the eye and says, we weren't very good at some things and we're cleaning it up, at least for 1 week, you give that a chance.
Hub, anything else that jumped out at you from the assistant coaches who were made available?
It obviously they're going to be guarded as best they can. I kind of went in depth with Dave Ragone on some of these questions that I have about Mitch's responsibility in the run game with the RPOs. And it really is kind of interesting because it in some respects it gets back to reading the defense the same way you're trying to read coverages and read the defense when you're throwing the ball down the field. But now you're going in one direction or the other, trying to decide, do I hand off or throw? And you have no idea what's coming at you from the blind side. And so it was a very interesting conversation. He acknowledged, as Matt did, you know, on yesterday actually when we talked about it, that there were some RPOs that maybe it would have been better if they, you know, had gone the opposite direction both ways, you know, handed it off or kept it and thrown it. Trubisky himself called himself out on the third and one he took the sack on. That was an RPO. He said that was the wrong decision. So I do think it's a conversation that nobody's been having that I'm aware of. And it's interesting to me that clearly the Bears coaching staff is very aware of it at this point. And it's hard for me not to imagine that it won't be a point of emphasis as they look at cleaning things up this Sunday.
We had a great conclusion, I thought, to week one last night. Both games very entertaining. I'm not quite sure what the Texans were thinking, giving Drew Brees an opportunity to get in field goal range for Will Lutz. But what were some of the stories that grabbed you the most in week one?
Well, let me start there because I've heard that a few times. And if you think about it, I'm not sure they really gave, you know, quote, gave Drew Brees a chance. I mean, they gave him, it was either 36 or 38 seconds, but they had to get down the field in a couple plays to get that touchdown. And that touchdown throw from Deshaun Watson to Kenny Stills that gave him the lead for a couple seconds is probably the best pass I've seen in the NFL in the last year or two. Everything about that play was so perfect. And just watching the last minutes, and then, of course, watching, you know, Brees, one of the ultimate artists, and then to see the kid Lutz step up and hit the 58-yarder, I'm sorry, that was just a great football game. And it was awful in the first half. I turned it off. I went away for the third quarter and came back. I was very impressed by the Dallas Cowboys. Granted, it was the Giants, but for Dak Prescott to play like that, and it's, you know, one game, good or bad, doesn't change everything, but I didn't know that Prescott had that in him, and so it's going to be very interesting to watch, particularly when he's obviously playing for somewhere in the vicinity of $110 to $120 million guaranteed. But very impressed by the Cowboys. I the Patriots, why talk about it? Did we expect anything different? They're the best team in the NFL. They're going to continue to be the best team in the NFL. I think the defense has caught up with the offense at this point. There'll be at some point in the season, they'll miss Gronk, but they were very impressive. I thought the game that Cincinnati gave Seattle, I didn't see that coming at all. And I expected Seattle to be much improved. Now, again, either way, you just don't overreact to these week one things. And one that has a lot of relevance here at home, the Vikings were super impressive, but I've actually been working the last hour or so on a preview of them. And when you look at how they did it, you still have to wonder if the Vikings have been fixed. They are not going to win a bunch of NFL games throwing 10 passes and only running 49 plays. So it's an interesting game to look at, but have the Vikings really fixed everything?
Yeah, they had some help from the special teams with a block punt deep in Atlanta territory early. They had a takeaway. Took advantage of those opportunities, but Dalvin Cook looked amazing. And Kamara last night was what kept me from turning the tube off in the first half. He's amazing.
Yeah, I'm in just one fantasy league. It's the Shaw Media League, and I only play to give everybody a chance to beat, quote, the football expert. And last night I was going into the game with a 13-point lead, and the team I was playing had Kamara, and I had Jared Cook in the Saints defense. And so that added some interest in the game for me. We're not really playing for anything except pride. And all through that first half when Kamara did nothing, I said, yeah, the game is not going to end this way. But I think that one of the reasons the Texans always won is because they didn't let Kamara beat him either. Unfortunately, it's just the way those last couple of minutes, unfortunately for the Texans, the way those last couple of minutes went, it worked out that way.
We're talking to Hub Arkish for another couple of minutes. Mike Pereira going to join us in about 10 here. McNeil and Parkins on the score. By the way, you mentioned Gronk, as you do. Rob Gronkowski just tweeted nothing more than the eyeball emojis. Normally the sign of an announcement coming. Don't know if it's related to his CBD product.
I'm sure it has something to do with a product. He's
I don't think he's coming back. He was on Fox and Friends and doing the media round this morning, but we'll at least see if Gronk is coming back. I am curious, Hub. I'm not normally a conspiracy theorist guy, but I do believe there's something to Antonio Brown wanted to be a Patriot. The Patriots wanted to trade for him. The Steelers wouldn't trade him to New England, so that this had been orchestrated for a long, long time. Do you think there's anything to the AB to New England conspiracy theories lasting months and months as opposed to days and days?
You know, I heard you guys talking about it a little bit yesterday, and I actually know Bill Belichick pretty well, and I know that there's a lot of thoughts about, you know, who he is and what he is. I will say emphatically, I don't dispute at all that it may have been a plan of Antonio Brown and Drew Rosenhaus, but I will say emphatically that Belichick had nothing to do with it. You know, there is tampering rules. There are penalties for tampering. If he did, you know, eventually this stuff always comes out, and they would get absolutely clobbered if he messed with something like this. And that's just my starting point. Beyond that, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You've got Pete Carroll coming out and saying, we absolutely tried to trade for him. I know John Dorsey tried to trade for him. We know that Brown wanted out of Oakland. It may be that the Patriots were his first choice, and that is why the Patriots were able to get the deal done so quickly. And by the way, now that you've seen the paper, it's not what Rosenhaus was trying to sell. You know, it's basically a million guaranteed, I think, is what he got so far. He's going to get another five very soon. And so the deal, these deals aren't that hard to put together when the two sides want to make a deal. So I understand why people talk about it. I agree with you that there's no question that Brown and Rosenhaus and maybe some other consultants were conspiring, but I do not believe for a minute that the Patriots had anything to do with it. They're just the best at taking care of the opportunity when it presents itself.
Well, it would be the first time, I guess, that the Patriots colored outside the rules of the NFL. You know,
but again, you know, Danny, consider the cost if you get caught. And Belichick's not a dummy, okay? If this turns out that there is something here, they are going to lose multiple first-round picks. This would be as bad as any tampering we've ever seen.
I agree.
And you've already seen what Goodell has done to them. We saw what Goodell did to him with no evidence in the Deflategate thing. And so, you know, I just Belichick's not that dumb.
I don't think he's dumb either. I just, something fishy's about it. I'm sorry. It just, the Raiders traded two draft picks for a guy that never plays for them, and he immediately ends up in the situation he wanted to go to in the first
place.
And when
you trace his behavior since camp started, that would be how you get your ass cut. Everything he did.
And Hub, you're probably right. That's why most conspiracy theories are wrong. There's just something about this that I'd like to know more about the timeline of it, frankly, because I do think beyond the punishment for the Patriots, I would say it if it was any team, like it brings the question of the legitimacy of transactions in the league in question if guys can just do this after they get traded to another team. Why would any team take the risk of trading for any player?
Well, to make sure they get them. I mean, we know it's been well documented. The Steelers had four teams that they would not trade Brown too. It was the Patriots and their three AFC North rivals. And it's interesting that we've been able to document that the Patriots and the Browns were at least two of the three teams that wanted them. And so, you know, you got to put the Steelers part of this in here too, which was that they were doing what they could to keep them away from these two teams. When he became available, we shouldn't be surprised, you know, that they were teams that were jumping in. But you got to add all kinds of pieces to this. Brown had $30 million guaranteed. Now he's got six. Why would he do that for the Patriots? I mean, even if it was the plan on the front end, once he realized it was going to cost him at least $24 million, why do it? Did you see the incentives he's got to hit to get the rest of that alleged guaranteed money?
Well, the incentives are ridiculous, but the incentives, I think, were only $1.5 million of it, right? It was a $9 million signing bonus broken up into two chunks and then the $20 million option that would be guaranteed for next year.
As I read it, he's got $1 million in his pocket right now, and he's got another five coming at some point. We don't know what, and I thought the balance was based on the incentives. But whatever it is, even if it's $9 million, he still gave away $21 million. And so for this to be a conspiracy between the two, what is Brown thinking that he would make, even if that was his plan? Once he got the $30 million, why not back out of it and play football there?
Listen, what is Antonio Brown thinking is a question that would take a long time to answer.
Be a good reality series.
And that, in the end, is why I don't see a conspiracy here, because we know that one half of it, I don't want to get too strong here and call them names, but clearly the elevator's not going all the way to the top there. And so when I look at what happened here, that's what I start with, not that the team that came in on the back end was involved in a conspiracy.
I just wonder if the elevator now goes all the way to the top and that he's in New England. I'm not giving this conspiracy theory
we'll
up.
See.
But you know,
what I mean? Oh, I'm not saying, listen, it's fun talk, and I'm not, who knows? We'll see. I will be shocked. And you know, the last piece of it, guys, is let's see how the next 4, 5, 10 weeks go. I was reading one really interesting piece on him last night. It's somebody from The Athletic out in the Bay Area who was worked closely with him, who Brown befriended, and he said, this man is not capable of showing up on time for anything, no matter what it is. Forget the practices missed, the late practices, the late game day or whatever. That's not going to fly with Belichick. And so, you know, all we hear about is how they rehab these guys. They don't all work out. And so let's see what happens the next 5, 6, 7 weeks, and then we'll have a better handle on it.
Great stuff, Hub. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
All right, take care, guys.
Thanks, Hub.
That's Hub Arkus. He was referencing Carson Palmer, who referenced Antonio Brown's tardiness. Just coming out, the referee assignments for week 2, Adrian Hill wearing the white hat.
Okay, one of our newbies.
For Bears and Broncos. We'll talk to Mike Pereira, former director of officiating, does the analyst work for the referees at Fox, next on The Score.
Michael Thomas with the effort.
Replay has stopped the game. The previous play is under review. After touching. Review, the ruling of a completed catch stands. The ball we placed on the 47-yard line, which results in a first down. The game clock is correct at 26 seconds.
All right, so now they're probably working on some administrative.
The conversation on the field is the game clock. Because we reverse to a running clock, we will take 10 seconds off the clock. We'll reduce it to 16 seconds.
John, what have we here?
I think everyone was kind of trying to figure out what we had would happen there on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, very, very confusing. We got a guy. We got a man who wore the white hat for a number of years, a supervisor of officials who understands these things, Parkins.
Yes, he does. Mike Pereira, the rules analyst at Fox Sports. Always kind to the McNeil and Parkins show because I enjoy it, but you are obsessed with the men who wear the white hats.
I'm a friend of the officiating community, a champion of their work. Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am great. How are you guys?
We are doing very, very well. Thank you for your time, as always. Not as we were expecting a wild week in terms of coaches challenging on defensive pass interference, offensive pass interference. It was pretty quiet. Were you surprised it was as quiet as it was?
No, really, because it was pretty consistent with what happened in preseason. And I think at that point in the preseason, coaches were more aggressive because they didn't concern themselves with timeouts. And so I said, really seeing how it worked out, I predicted that there would be less than one stoppage per game for pass interference. I'm not sure what happened last night in the two games, but in the first 14, there was only eight stoppages. Two of those were actually had defensive pass interference added on. So, you know, it seems like it's not a big deal because it's going to be less than one per game. Of course, you look at the overall total figures. If you have 256 games, it's going to be a lot more challenges that they had last year. But I really think it's not going to be that big of an issue.
We had you on when the rule was announced, and like me, you really did not like it because it seems like it's not going to be as frequent. Have you changed your stance on the ability to officiate plays via video?
Well, I still don't like it because I don't like replay involved in something that is so subjective. You could look at the, I don't know if you saw much of the San Francisco-Tampa Bay game, but toward the end of the game, 31-17, not a big deal, but Richard Sherman is not called for pass interference. The replay show stops the game because it was inside of 2 minutes, and it wasn't changed, it wasn't added, but it's interference. I mean, I think in any official, if he got to see it again with Richard Sherman never playing the ball and making contact, and yeah, the receiver put his hands out kind of to ward him off, but it's so subjective that it leads you down this road of is it, isn't it, was it? And so I don't like it. I mean, there had to be a way to figure out, how to correct something as blatantly obvious as what happened in New Orleans last year. But I still look at this as it being a one-year rule. I mean, I think it's going to turn off some owners in the end, and when they have to vote on it again next year, I don't think it'll pass. But at least it's not going to be what we all predicted, including me, 3 or 4 extra stops per game. Thank God that's not happening.
Yeah, really. You know, I never thought I would ask this question as to whether punching a player in the face is a subjective call, but I'm wondering after week one, Miles Jack of the Jaguars gets tossed for striking a Chiefs player with an open hand in the face, and Myles Garrett of the Browns does the same thing to a Titans player and only gets an unnecessary roughness penalty. Why wasn't there consistency? Did you see those two infractions?
Well, I saw the Miles Jack one, and he had, like, totally lost control. I mean, even before the punch, whether it was closed fist or open hand, I mean, he was out of control. And I know they said that he basically got hit first or undercut first, but I think sometimes you have to add into the equation control of the game, and it may cause you to eject. Now, the interesting thing is again, this is new. This rule this year is new when it comes to the Miles Jack type penalty that New York, when they get a chance to look at it, they can actually eject them even if the official doesn't. So if they see a blow or a control situation that they think is beyond what the official saw on the field, they can jump in and eject. Now, I think with Miles Jack, they did it on the field because they felt how things were getting out of control. But it just seems a little bit to me like New York has too much on their plate right now, and they ought to maybe not get so overly involved that they lose track of timing in replay situations, if you know what I mean.
We're talking to Mike Pereira, the former VP of officiating rules analyst for Fox Sports. In a big picture sense, do you think officials and officiating has improved or gotten worse since instant replay became a thing?
Well, I think that's a good question. I'm going to say this. I hate to say that it's gotten worse. That are actually like targets my friend, so to speak, but I don't think it's gotten any better. I believe that they're going through a transition period to a degree, not necessarily related to instant replay. But never in my time did you have 7 new referees in a 2-year period. I mean, that's incredible. It takes time to adjust to the referee position, and this whole turnover, and there's some more coming in the next year or two, is pretty incredible. But I think replay, I would say this, replay overall has helped in terms of getting the calls on the field right. They're getting more calls on the field right than they did before because of replay and because of replay's ability to correct things. But I also think that in a way it's a crutch, and you have to be worried about a crutch. I'm an old-time, old-school guy. I love football being played on the field. I loved it being officiated on the field. When I was the head of officiating and was responsible for all the mistakes, I didn't mind replay coming back and helping me out. But I look at it now more as a fan, and I'm not really enthused about the timing of the game and all the breaks and the number of stoppages and minutia that happens when you stop it to see, did the ball move? Oh, my God, was this spot? Did they miss the spot by 6 inches, and therefore we have to move it 6 inches and see if it's a first down? It's gone beyond the obvious, which replay was designed back in 1999 when we brought it back in to catch the obvious mistake, and it continues to grow. And as it grows further into judgment, that's when I start getting to be concerned, because you cannot officiate judgment at different speeds. You can't substitute the regular speed that an official has to see it in with slow motion replay that we give them as a network. So in a way, it's made it tougher, but I don't think it's made officiating any better.
That's a really interesting answer. I would get your opinion of what the call was last night on the missed point after try by the Texans when they get another chance with the roughing the kicker penalty. Did they get it right?
Well, I certainly think they did. You know, the rule states basically if the kicker can regain his balance and get both feet on the ground, then you can't have running into the kicker. But you can have roughing the kicker. And to me, the kicker didn't do anything as opposed to, like, run forward to get hit low. You know, the course, the direction that the defender took him into the ankle. I think it was the left ankle. And you're always concerned when a player, any player, has feet planted on the ground and then takes a shot to the ankle like that. So to me, that wasn't a questionable call at all. I think had they not called that, there would have been just as much angst, you know, that would have been coming from Houston as there is from New Orleans.
Mike, I want you to hear a soundbite from Thursday night's broadcast on NBC. We were looking for something to make us laugh, to feel better on Friday after the way the Bears played, and we found something. Chris Collinsworth giving it to your old buddy Terry McCauley.
Well, Terry McCauley is our rules analyst, and Terry, got to get you into the show here.
Thanks very much, Al.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly pass interference, not playing the ball, significantly hinders the receiver. Right there, defensive pass interference.
Some of your best stuff, man.
They should all be that easy, Terry.
I wish they were.
Yeah.
Classic, wasn't it?
That's great. I didn't hear that. Every once in a while, you get some stuff. It's like the referee at the USC game last week, which, you know, you'd have loved. You loved officials. But the clock ran out at the end of the half. Stanford let it run out, and he made the announcement that's the end of the first half. Unbeknownst to him, Stanford had called a timeout with 2 seconds to go, and then he turned on his microphone and said, "I was just kidding. There's 2 seconds to go." And you get some of those sound bites that are just terrific.
Did you ever have an all-time one, like one that sticks with you?
No, not really. Not one that I can remember. We seemed to be sometime during my time a little bit more stoic, so I don't really remember one that's either a slip of the tongue or something I did deliberately.
And then do the referee brethren give it to Ed Hockley for hogging the mic time?
Oh my God, they give him for two things: hogging the mic time, that's one. And then buy an extra small referee shirt so that he looks really big in them.
Yeah, you know, he gets fresh Under Armour.
That's the other thing they get him.
When he was repping, fresh Under Armour. Every stadium he goes to, there's all kinds of colors waiting for
him. His shirt is painted on.
Mike, good stuff as always. Give us a little bit on Adrian Hill, who will referee the Bears game. He's one of two first-year referees this year. He'll wear jersey number 29.
Obviously.
One of just the seventh only African-American who's been a head referee at the professional level. I find that a little bit disrepresentative, I would think. I don't know if guys don't want to go into that craft. You could maybe enlighten us on that from your younger years. But what do you know about Adrian?
Well, Adrian, you know, we actually brought Adrian in and looked at him as a potential referee because he had done some refereeing in college, and we liked what we saw. The one thing that we learned from Adrian right off the bat, a great rules guy. They could have used him last night in New Orleans. I didn't, in the NFL level, I haven't seen him work preseason games. Prior to our game in Miami that we had in week three. And so I got to watch him actually work a full game because it was on Fox. And I actually called Al River on and said, holy mackerel, Adrian Hill has had a hell of a game. I mean, he had three roughing the passer calls that were all legit calls, not questionable. He talked a 15-year umpire out of a holding call correctly, because the umpire, there just wasn't enough for it to be a foul. So I was really impressed with Adrian. Smart guy, but he's also going through the process of learning. I mean, that's just the way it is. But, you know, side judges, they don't have to handle television, and they don't have to handle the microphone, excuse me, and the different things between quarters. So it's an adjustment for him, but he's got a good, strong crew. He's got some veterans on his crew, so I expect him to perform well all season.
Mike Pereira, the former VP of officiating and rules analyst for Fox Sports. We always really do appreciate you being generous with your time for the show. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
You got it, guys. Take care.
That is Mike Pereira answering all of your rules questions. And you'll be happy to know, Adrian Hill, great rules guy.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to a good rules guy out there. You know, when your quarterback can't complete a forward pass and, you know, your team's getting pumped on the road. A good rules guy will really make it all much
better.
They could
have used them in New Orleans. It's like, aren't they all a great rules guy? Don't they all know the rules? Some of them know the rules better than other guys?
Sometimes you wonder why in the world you ask a question like that. Tell me all I need to know. His excitement level. I called Hal Riveron. Boy, this guy blows a hell of a whistle.
I love it when an official can really just splash, fly off the page. Makes all the officials around him better.
Talking like he was a D-end prospect at the combine.
Really did.
Yeah, his shuffle time is fantastic. A great rules guy.
Oh, that's great. Now I'm glad I asked the question. I realized as soon as I asked it, it was really dopey to ask the question. And Tanny's shaking his head. Boy, an hour after suicide.
McNeil and Parkins on the Score. Thanks again to Mike Pereira of Fox Sports for taking some time to join the show.
I think that's one of the best hires Fox made. What is it, about 10 years or so ago now? Been around that long.
Man.
Yeah, been a while. And they've worked Dean Blandino into it, and I think they were sharing a studio last year. What I saw in opening week, and I didn't see anything in the preseason about how Fox was going to handle this, they're doing different games. They're not sharing the stage anymore and debating. But one of them will get a handful of games to do, and the other one will get a bunch of different games. Dean Blandino was the guy who was doing all the work on the Vikings in their easy win over the Falcons. So I got Dean Blandino at noon. And later in the day, went to a CBS game, so I didn't see Mike all day, which bothers me when I don't see Mike all day. It's not opening day without Mike Pereira saying something about a guy enthusiastically blowing a whistle.
Tanny always says that.
He does. Yeah, he always has.
Fox created that gig and then is cornering the market. You know, because Dean Blandino is probably the second best officiating expert in television, and Pereira being the best. And they both work at Fox, because we had the Mike Carey disaster with CBS and Terry McAuley.
Gerald Austin. Austin was the worst of all of them because he looked like he was a corpse. Jerry, you have to elbow him. Make sure he hasn't just been freshly embalmed earlier in the day. He only lasted a year or two in the ESPN booth. Mike Carey would be number two in terms of bad.
And he was only a couple of seasons with CBS.
McCauley's nothing special on NBC. I don't think Terry McCauley's particularly good.
No, I thought
Terry McCauley is our rules analyst. And Terry, got to get you into the show here.
Got to work you in somehow, Terry. You're here. You're on the payroll. We only have one game.
Terry, this one's obvious. Please jump in here. Earn a check.
Then he says offensive. I mean defensive.
Bust a grape, will you, Terry?
It'll happen. What an easy check, by the way. Yeah. If you one game a week and it's a clean game and you're the rules analyst, that's incredible. First class accommodations, the whole thing. But in terms of other broadcast stuff, I got to say, Booger McFarland away from the Boogermobile last night, it made for a smoother broadcast.
Thought it was a better broadcast as well, but
you're not a Tessitore fan.
I am. I'm a Tessitore fan, but he needs a cup of decaf. The game is selling itself. When you have great play going on in front of you, and you don't need to constantly be providing a narrative. We can see the game on television. His decibel level needs to be brought down considerably. He shouts at you. He zigs and zags for 3 hours and never comes up for air.
He's got a great voice, though.
His voice is heavenly. Yes.
It's an amazing voice.
He's got a terrific voice. His voice screams presence. Big game voice. He does have that, but everything is the greatest, is the biggest. Third down and 9 yards. Relax, dude. We're first
quarter. The white gloves are on the Hall of Fame president, David Baker.
You know what I'm saying? He oversells everything.
He has a great voice, and so he uses it to the maximum all the time.
Slow down, champ. The voice is gold. The voice is terrific. He gets the game. He, you know, from a craft standpoint, I think his play-by-play is really, really solid.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
I just think the presentation needs a ton of work. He needs to slow it the F down.
Yeah, I think the obvious move was the move they made. Not adding a third person to that booth and just getting rid of the Boogermobile.
What game you watching, Boog?
I'm going to just shout down to you down there on the field, even though we're in the same broadcast. But just the ability to just have one person standing there talking to the next person. It's so tough to pull off. I know you did a great three-man radio show, but it's so tough to get chemistry with two people, much less three.
Radio is, I think, a lot easier to work three guys in than it is doing a broadcast. I would prefer a three-man booth, but if a two-man booth is really, really good, I don't mind just the two with the sideline reporter.
Yeah.
And bunch of new ones I saw this weekend. Didn't commit any of the names to memory, but some real talent out there, especially in our game involving the Chargers and Colts. I look forward to seeing more of her work, whatever her name
is. I don't remember. There were
She's
new.
Just delightful.
There were new reporters all over the place. That's another benefit, man, of no bye weeks. You have all these broadcast crews.
Yes.
But the Bears coming back down to earth, by the way. Dick Stockton and Mark Schlereth.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Yeah,
they deserve it.
That's one nickname that I just
stink.
Yeah, it's just really.
I mean, that's too juvenile.
Yeah, I guess that's where I draw the line.
Okay.
I mean, when we were teammates at the same operation, it was just, when he would guest with us in person. It's just, you know, and somebody would say, it just bugs me.
Someone asked on the text line if Booger was the birth name of Booger McFarland.
No, his Christian name is Beaumont Livingston. No, his Christian name is Anthony. He's Anthony Booger McFarland. He had the first sack in Super Bowl 41, Bears and Colts, middle of the third quarter when Rex Grossman tripped on his shoelaces and dropped back to pass on a 2nd-and-1. Not that I've not forgiven Ron Turner for that. That bet went a long way. I had a wager that lived into the middle of the third quarter, a lot longer than first touchdown in the game, because Devin Hester answered that in 10 seconds.
Yeah, that one was easy.
Whoops, there goes $440. But I bet the Bears in the over.
Oh, tough day at the window. Texter says you guys could pull.
Hang on, I'm sorry. I'm just picturing McVie, the one guy who's angry about Hester running it back in the first play of the Super Bowl.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I was jumping up. I would have been happy to lose that one. Jumping up and down and right behind Jerry Angelo's family, too. So I wanted to make sure his wife, Vange, I think her name was, and his daughters. I wouldn't want to do anything negative about the Bears with those guys right around me.
So where were your seats?
35-yard line. Under the overhang, so we were nice and dry.
Position A.
Four seats away from Jesse Jackson.
Wow.
What do you think of that? Eight seats away from the Burger King mascot. I was rubbing elbows with the who's who.
I've seen Jesse Jackson at the airport probably six times. I always run into Jesse Jackson when I'm traveling.
Good interview. If you get him on a good cell phone. I think I've had him on the air three times.
I'd love to get him to tell stories.
Every time the cell drops.
Really?
Every single time.
That guy's got to just have some incredible stories.
Yeah.
You could ask him about Walter Payton, Michael Jordan.
Jordan brings his teammates to a new level.
Dr. King.
Yeah.
You could ask him about
anybody. I would love to. We'd get him in studio, not over the phone, because his cell phone's bad.
Let's get him in studio and have him make some NFL picks.
Shep, get on that.
We can do that. We can get it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Shep
will get Jesse Jackson right after he finds Mark DeRosa.
We're still working on DeRosa. Can we just get John Morosi to hand DeRosa a phone? I'll get you DeRosa tomorrow. I'll text Morosi.
Where's Nick? I got to meet Shep.
You saw him every Thursday last year, Dave.
No.
Shep making an impression on why at the golf.
Which one's Nick?
Guy you were just Who pulls this up to. For you? Did you do that yourself?
I forgot that Waddy did that at the golf outing. That's incredible. Both of them. They're our guys. The Shep Army, the Waddy Army.
Right.
They're our guys. It's Mac and Parkins on the score.